Hi, my name is Dr. Jessica Puri, and my Black is transnational.
You are listening to Season 5 of My Dad's Podcast, My Black is Transnational, a podcast about Blackness and reconnecting back to our native homelands. Find us wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. Check us out on YouTube. You can follow us on Instagram or blacktransnational.com. Thank you for listening and enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome. You are listening to My Black is Transnational. My name is Dr. Kalechi Bay Lamberts, and coming up on this episode, I have the pleasure of talking with Dr. Jessica Puri, who is a researcher and scholar at Northwestern University in Illinois, and we get to talk about the transnational impact of female genital cutting. We also get to talk about her transnational upbringing, being from the North in Nigeria, and her transnational relationship being married to someone that's an African-American. But before we get into that, let's go through our formalities. If this is your first time listening to My Black is Transnational, you can find this podcast wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. Please be sure to follow us on social media. We're available on YouTube. You can find us on Instagram at Black Transnational Podcast. You can follow me, the host, at Black Transnational _. You can find us on Twitter at MB Transnational. And finally, you can check out our website at www.blacktransnational.com. Oh, we're also on Facebook, which is connected to Instagram as well, at Black Transnational Podcast. All right. So I'm very excited about sharing this episode and conversation with you all. It's a very direct, I mean, I think we could have talked forever, but we were on a limited time. We were on a time crunch because my girl is busy. And respectfully, I appreciated her time and wanted to take advantage of it while we could. But we got into, Dr. Jessica Puri and I got into a great conversation. I think we often don't talk about, at least when we talk about the transnational impact of things, right? Women who immigrate to the U.S. who may have experienced female genital cutting. I know some people use the term female genital mutilation, but that's not necessarily the most culturally sensitive term. So we use FGC over here. And so with that, this episode is very interesting because we first start off just talking about her, her background, her passion for her religion, her passion for her husband. We talk about their experiences and relationships being from different parts of the Black, subcultural groups, you know, her being African immigrant while he is African American Jamaican, you know, by roots. So talking about their dynamic and how they've gone to blend and become one. And then we get into the conversation about her passion and her research in terms of, you know, female genital cutting and the impact and all the health risks that play a role. And so I really enjoy this episode because I think we get into the public health dynamic, and you all get to experience me get into my public health bag. We get to really talk a lot more about those aspects of things, maybe compared to previous episodes that you've heard on this podcast. We really get into the scholarly conversation, which I enjoy from time to time. And it was still informal, of course, but I think you all will enjoy it. And maybe you all can learn a thing or two about the impact of, FGC on people and what it could possibly mean moving forward. And so I just wanted to take the time to appreciate Dr. Puri for taking her time to be able to share and enlighten us and share some knowledge. And I hope you all enjoyed this conversation because it was a very powerful and informative one. It was a very brief one too, but nevertheless worth it. So without any further ado, here's my conversation with Dr. Jessica Puri. Enjoy. All right. Hello. Welcome to an episode of My Black is Transnational. And I have on here today our special guest, Dr. Jessica Puri, representing Northwestern University, but most importantly, representing Nigeria. Dr. Puri is a current faculty member at the Northwestern University, writer, lecturer, very passionate about issues related to health, adolescence experiences, especially gender-based violence. We'll talk a little bit about the genital mutilations and things of that nature. But a transnational herself, born in Nigeria, immigrated here, living that life. And so she is here to talk about experience. Dr. Puri, welcome. What's going on?
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here. Dr. Kelly, do you prefer Dr. Kel? or Dr. Kelechi? Is that that's a
You
feeling?
know, Dr. Kells, no, I mean, professionally, when I'm on these areas, I mean, Dr. You know, call me Dr. Kells, Dr. Ibe Lambert, Kelechi, you know, it don't, like, for the show, you my sis, it don't matter, just, you know, call,
Right. I like Dr. Kell. That's like it's like official but casual.
Call me
I
Dr.
get
Kells then, but you gotta put the S in it, so it's Kells,
Oh, Kell's got it. Okay. That's fair. That's fair.
So yeah, man, but yes, thank you again, welcome to the show, how you doing? I normally give people an opportunity to just, like, introduce themselves. I give you your accolades, but I also want you to take an opportunity to introduce yourself formally to the audience.
It's always interesting which direction I decide to go with introducing myself, depending on the space, right? So, Dr. Puri, I go by Jess, Doc J, all of it. I am a wife, a daughter, a sister, and transnational, still figuring out my experience just with the as growth is happening and identities are, taking place. But I have lived in the US since 2011. I have lived in Chicago the whole time. I fell in love with the city, so came here, did my undergrad at Loyola, master's at DePaul, doctorate at Northwestern. Clearly have no loyalties to any university. I just my thing is just I just love Chicago. I just love the city. Every time I visit other places, I'm like, how I'm gonna go back though. So I've absolutely loved it here. Met my husband here too. We've been married about 2.5 years. Together for years. He is African American. He's from Dallas, so that is a whole other kind of experience of blackness. Navigate a whole other identity to navigate. Even when we talk about blackness and as a black woman, but also African, but him a black man from the South. So that's a little bit about myself. Oh, I guess my jobs.
I'm here. Yeah, you got the good backdrop. You ain't looking
Yeah.
official. They got the
Notice I
degrees
said
on the
jobs
wall.
plural, like a good Nigerian.
Yes,
I lecture at Northwestern, like you said, but I also teach at DePaul, an intro to public health course. And I'm a content writer for a mental health app that focuses on Gen Z, so everyone from ages 13 to 25. And that is really fun because I get to be an academic and a creative at the same time and, kind of merge them both in the writing space.
yeah. Wow. I mean, you're hustling and you're representing. All right, so let's get into it. I think many of the people on the show kind of, you know, understand how we go, and you know, I always talk about, like, your upbringing, and I talk about, like, what that experience is like, but I want to work a little bit backwards, right? And I kind of want to take it to you, because, and the reason I'm doing that is because you did something that I think most people that I interview naturally don't do, which is, you said, I'm a wife, you know, I'm a wife, I'm a Christian. Those are the first things you introduced yourself at. You didn't say, I'm a scholar from Northwestern. Introduce yourself as your personal, the things that your personal life, you put that on the forefront first. And so that's important. And I want to then unpack that, because you also mentioned and described your husband's background, and its difference from yours, right? And so I want to know what that was like, and I want to start there, because I think it's easy to kind of get into the whole, like, transnational back forth from you, and we'll get into that, but I want to know what that cultural experience was like, for you and him, when you all met, when you know, when of course he knew you were Nigerian, and how you all started to navigate these things individually and then together when you all got married.
I mean, we're one now, right? So like when I think of my identity, I gotta think,
I
think of
love
that
it.
part too. But I guess going back, so so wife, Christian, daughter. So everything, all of my experiences coming to the US, picking my career, all of that have really hinged on my faith. And like a it's been like honestly, it is like scripture that has gotten me through a lot of these like, very specific big life moments. So, for instance, when I was wondering what career I wanted to go into, Matthew 25:35 really like stuck out to me in a way it never had. So it's the verse that says, "When I was hungry, Jesus was talking with his disciples, and he goes, "When I was hungry, you fed me. When I was in prison, you visited me. When I was naked, you clothed me." And it's like a bunch of these like random things that his disciples were like, "When did we do any of that?" And he says, "When you did that for the least of these, you did it for me." And that for me covered everything: public health, mass incarceration, food insecurity, poverty, forced migration, all of it. I was like, "Oh, okay, So I guess that's what I'm doing in my life. So if Jesus was here in the flesh as a black woman living in the US, he'd probably be a public health professional. So it was a much
At
longer
the
journey
very
into
least, a social worker.
that. Right? Like
Hey.
he was, I was like, wow, Jesus really touched on all of that, but like the way that he usually does, very poetically and straight to the point. And that spoke to the creative in me. But my husband and I met when we were in undergrad. I was at Loyola. He was at Northwestern. And we both volunteered for the same ministry. It was a Christian ministry on campus. We were both student leaders through it. And he was just one of the bros. Like, objectively speaking, he was cute. But like, there was like none of that there. Like, you're just like, ha-ha, kicking and all that. So we were friends for like 6 or 7 years. And then he, this is so dramatic, he called Chicago the land of his affliction. So he was like, as soon as he was done, like he, because he grew up in Dallas, like he was not about the
Oh, the
cool.
coast, he was out of there.
But literally the day after his graduation,
Out of there, out of there, out of there.
he always says, he remembers telling his mom, he's like, my wife ain't here. Like there's like nothing for me in Chicago here. He left.
Wow.
And yeah, like she thinks it's so funny. But
Man.
when it, so we reconnected, he traveled a bit for work. And at this time that we reconnected, he was living in North Carolina, Greensboro, North Carolina. Doc, nobody lived there. It was him and the gas station. No, it was one of those towns or those areas where, like, you're on a long road trip and you
Yeah,
stop for us.
you're super
Yeah, that's
rural.
great. Yeah, so very, which is kind of very telling of the kind of person he is. He's very, he's a social butterfly, but he loves his privacy and like does not mind living in the woods,
Okay,
apparently,
got you.
which he was like the only black man, right, living in the woods. Very interesting. But we reconnected at a friend's wedding, and it was one of those like out of sight, out of mind things for me, but I didn't realize at the time he had been praying about his wife and like who God wanted, who God wanted him to be with, because this is like a big life thing. If you're going to spend your
Oh,
life
yeah.
with somebody, like you want to think about it, you want to pray about it. I'm giving the very like a short version because this is much longer and his side is also longer. But we literally had not talked in years, and we didn't have each other on social media. I don't think he even had social media anymore at that time. So like really out of sight, out of mind. He was coming into town for that wedding, and he's like preparing and stuff, and he's praying about the trip or whatever, and I pop in his mind out of nowhere. And he was like, At the time, he had a list. I didn't know this until we're engaged. He had a list of like 29 things. And I'm glad he didn't tell me till we were engaged. But it's like, Jessica sounds like she could be the person that like fits everything on the list.
Wow.
And like his thing too is like, if you're missing one thing, that you ain't his wife. So anyway, he prayed. He was like, well, Lord, if Jessica's my wife, if it's your will that I pursue her till marriage, let me bump into her this weekend when I go to Chicago. He didn't know I was even friends with the people that he was coming to town to see the wedding. I happened to be invited to that wedding too. Long story short, we're like sitting at the same table at the reception, and like we reconnect. And I'm like, you a man now. And it was like, it's like, hey, you look different. I was like, did you grow your facial hair or something? He's like, nah, girl, I look the same. But long story short, we reconnect and we start dating again. And, oh, sorry, we start dating and eventually get married. But so he had always known I was Nigerian. Like, in fact, I think the first time we met, I remember, I think I asked him if he was Nigerian, because to me he had very Nigerian features. He was like, no, I'm from the South, I'm from Dallas, born in Oklahoma. It's like, oh, sorry. So he's always known, right? And my accent, I think, was thicker, and I code switch a lot,
Me
so
too.
he's like heard me do all of
Love
it.
the
He's
code
heard my
switching.
new professional black girl voice, he's heard my Nigerian accent, all of it. So as far as navigating our identities, I think it wasn't something that we were necessarily thinking about, very forefront, because we knew each other for so long. Also, just having lived here for so long, I was like used to having several African American friends. I was aware of differences within our cultures, but like also in love with our similarities. So, for instance, the way that we honor our parents, and the way that we like want our parents to be a part of some of the more specific things in our lives without sharing too much with our parents, because it's not everything that
Oh,
they're
they
trying to
need
know.
to know, yeah.
So I met his parents This was, we started dating August of 2019. I met his parents November, and I remember thinking, "Wow, our moms are the same person. Like they're very similar. They're a little different, but they're very similar. And our dads are very similar." So, like all of that just kind of eased me into the idea of like becoming a part of a family that was not Nigerian, because there's so many things that were very similar to my upbringing. They like both Christian, very similar values. He came with me to Nigeria in March of 2021, because we got married May 2020. So he came with me in March to like get some like in-person time with my family. And I think that was very different for him. Like he would say, "Man, I don't know if like African Americans can really come back to somewhere, to some parts of Nigeria and just easily reassimilate, because everything is so different.
It's
Like there's
different.
just," I was like, "Yeah, actually, that makes a lot of sense." He enjoyed it. He really wants to go back. Like we're figuring out the next time we'll be able to make a trip, but he felt so loved. He felt, he's light skinned compared to me and my family. Like my family, we're all dark. My parents have this thing where they don't call him their son-in-law. To him, that's their son. He's tall. He's over 6 feet. My parents are 5'5". So my dad would be like, "That's my son," introduce him as his son and not explain. And just on people are looking confused, like, when did
The color complexion everywhere. Bring it
But he
oil.
really
When they say
like
like you
became
bring an oil person.
exactly. It was so my rule was like, whenever we go out, just don't talk, please. Because like the moment they hear your
Oh, it's
accent,
over for you.
your target. So like we're not doing that. But I mean, it was a really great time. And then I have two younger sisters. They absolutely love him. He's the brother they never had. So like, it has really helped as far as culture and all that our families genuinely love each other, and there's like a genuine respect. Even in the cultural differences, they're like united in the fact that they love the Lord and they love us, and like we're one family now. If we have kids eventually, like that's all theirs, So, that's kind of a long answer to your
I mean, but
question.
it's an insightful one, right? And it's an insightful one because I'm even as you're talking about it, I'm reflecting on mine. I'm also married to an African American woman. I have children with her, and and that in its own right is interesting because of how my kids will also start to construct their identity as they get to, my age and beyond. And so I'm thinking about that process. And did you have to? It doesn't sound like you had to overcome any of those expectations or fight any stereotypes that were presumed about African Americans with your parents, right? Or did you still have to kind of
Oh,
do some
good
convincing?
question. I don't think so. I think so I have a very core memory of being maybe like 15 or so. I had gone back home to Nigeria over the summer. I was in church, and this one lady who like had no business trying to ask very personal questions. She was like, "Oh, are
Per
you
usual.
dating yet? Blah blah." I was like, not really." Sorry, I wasn't 15. I was already living in the US. So I was definitely older than 17, because I was 17 when I came here. Anyway, I'm back home and everything. And she's like, "Well, whatever you do, just don't bring back those Black Americans. You know how they are." I was like,
Exactly.
I was thankful that a comment like that didn't come from my family. But I became very aware that there was a disconnect, and a lot of it is really just coming from media portrayals.
Absolutely.
So not, it was not anyone's, it was not, this person was not speaking out of a lived experience or
Right.
anything. And we know we have issues with that, with media portrayals in the US, but thankfully I didn't have to work through any of that. My parents really just saw my husband for who he is, like a lovely man who genuinely loves me and loves and honors them. And he did a pretty good job of showing it very early on that he respected them and he honored them and he wanted to learn about their culture and learn about their expectations of him. But a big part of it too was the way I presented him. So, because my parents trust me, and like they trust the work that they've done. So For them, it was like, oh, she's bringing someone home. He's not an idiot.
Yeah.
Like he's
Yeah.
like, he, she speaks about him. So it was multiple things that played into it. And
Yeah.
thankfully, because all those things were in place, I really didn't have to do any extra work
Yeah.
later.
You know, you bring up something that I and your art the part that was interesting is that you see what you said in terms of like I they trusted you and they didn't see for me, I kind of had to have that conversation. Not in its
Okay.
in full entirety with my folks. It was like it was kind of very similar where I just kind of had to, I didn't have to say much, but I kind of also just hinted like, if you have a problem with the type of person I'm bringing home, then, or at least if you have that fear, then you don't trust what you did. Right. And
Exactly.
that was my rationale as well in terms of raising me, right? Like, I'm not going, I spent this whole part of my life trying to make y'all proud and do all of this. Why would I now jeopardize that? You know, not to say that I'm putting it, put your family, you know, in a high priority, but of course, I want to make sure that my happiness in terms of finding the one that I want to be with for the rest of my life is priority. But I'm not going, I'm like you said, I'm not going to bring someone an idiot. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not going to bring anybody that's going to just embarrass all of us, right? And so this thing will be planned, and you have certain, like your husband, boxes, and you know, you're trying to make sure that there are certain things you want to check and that aligns to make sure that, okay, this is someone that can be fitting, not just with you on a day-to-day basis, but can fit your family, can understand and respect your culture as open-minded, may not necessarily know, but wants to learn, right? And then you all can be able to learn from what teach each other different things. And that was another thing where for me, I was never one to tell my wife, like, this is what you must do. Right, like after now that you're here and you're with us and you just are on the African side, you must now do this. Right? No, it was all about there. I've also understood being here as long as I've been here that their African American culture has its values and its history and its richness and its and the impact that it has on the world is sometimes underappreciated and in its own right, you know, it needs we need to learn more about that and how they've been able to devise something that has, you know, done so much for so many people, and whether and that's not just black people, all across the world. And so, for me though, I did have those conversations with my parents where they're like, "Oh, don't go out and bring home, you know, African Americans." And there's another derogatory word they use. I don't want to use it today, but so that don't go and bring home this person. Don't go and bring home African Americans. You know, all these stereotypes. And for like having parents and people who raised me that like have been here. These stereotypical notions I found were very, I just didn't understand the distaste because my experiences with African Americans were always normal. They were always expected. This is what, you know, you take the, and but I also understood that I made a concerted effort to learn the history. I made a concerted effort to immerse myself in understanding Black and African American history in the US. So I understood and could relate and was for you just like I can code switch and I was able to kind of, you know, blend in different environments. But when it came to like my partner, my wife, I kind of felt like in before we get to the stage of marriage, I needed to kind of advocate. Not necessarily like not hard, but I had to present her well, right? Just like you did with yours. Like the way I presented her was kind of essentially like, oh, she's not like the others. Which in its own right was kind of like, you know, but you gotta pick your battles, right? Like it's like, you know, you pick your battles in this situation where it's like, oh, you're not like the others. And it's like, wait a minute, what do you mean by that? But like, but she also got to go to Nigeria in 2017 and she got that experience. Huh? We were in
What
Abuja.
part?
We went to Abuja first. And then the second time we came back, we went to the village in Imo State.
Okay.
Yeah, so it was crazy. It was crazy, but it was an experience for her. And I think the first time she was like, man, this is nice. All black people, you know, very similar. You're welcome. You're home. You're our daughter, blah, blah, blah. So she gets that experience, you know. But then I think the second time was like, okay, I'm here. It's cool. But man, like structurally, this environment is kind of, like, where's the light? You know, like, where's the light? Where's this? Where's that? Like, I don't know if I could do this for an
Where's
extended
the
period of time, right? Like, you know, and I couldn't blame her. She's like, by the time we went to, I mean, but in all fairness, I also understood that, like, I didn't, and not necessarily unintentionally, but like, I didn't give ourselves the opportunity to also see the finer things that Nigeria particularly has to offer. We didn't get that experience. We kind of came in on business, right? It was like, we came in, we want to do family things, familiar, and get that stuff out the way. So we didn't come for enjoyment, you know? And that's something that I still, you know, as we continue to move on in this married life, is something that I still feel that I owe her and myself, but I owe us, I guess I'll say, is that I want us to be able to enjoy enjoyment. And when I say enjoyment, that's Nigerian enjoyment, African enjoyment. Like, we haven't gotten that taste of it for real yet. And that's what I think is on my bucket list of things for us to do, because we just never had that opportunity. I think, you know, so, but in just taking everything that you said into consideration as far as the experiences, we've had to have, Wanda and I have had to have, you know, conversations just about just everything that has to do with the black and African American, the interracial tension between African immigrants or black immigrants and, you know, African Americans, or, you know, the ADOs community, whatever they want to call it. But I've always had to just make sure we get that straight. And it's not something that we don't debate about or anything, but it's just something that we always get to share perspective on. Like, yo, I see it this way and I never saw it like this, or you all do this way and we do it. So we find similarities and differences in terms of, like, one interesting thing, right? Just to share, and for those who listen, you may have heard this before in other seasons, but just the way we describe cousins, right? Like, for me, you know, anyone that, like, is in my generation, whether, you know, you're my cousin, my mom's cousin's son, or you're, like, you know, you're my cousin, right? We don't do, like, first gen, you're my first cousin. We don't do second cousin, third. Like, it's not something that I grew up really, like, understanding that particular terminology. It wasn't until I got here where I'm like, oh, what is a first cousin? What is a second cousin? Like in my mind, like, sounding ignorant. Like, it's like, first cousin, that's the person you see first. That's, like, the person, like, you know. Is it the cousin that you see first? That's your first cousin. That's, like, a fair question. Is that your number, like, one cousin? Like, I'm confused.
Yeah. That's a fair question.
You know, so I didn't know. That's my ignorance. But those are the things, the cultural, like, the interactions, those are the type of conversations that we have sometimes in our personal time, is just trying to figure out because for our kids, how do we describe this? Because to me, the way I look at it is, my cousin, whether, I don't care what, for a second, but my cousin's kid is your cousin. That's it.
Right.
And but for her, she might be like, my cousin's kid is your second or third cousin, you know, twice removed or something. So
just mental gymnastics. That's what it is. And sometimes we're just not trying to do all that.
You know, it's just those are the things that I just be like, you know, these are conversations, the different types of conversations that we have among ourselves. And I don't know how you all, as you all continue to plan y'all lives together, but do y'all have those type of, like, similar type of vibes or no?
Well, we don't have kids yet. So there's some things that we're like, we'll cross that bridge when we get there. Right. But we're also very similar in, you know, even in the way that we see family, like, it's, you know, the cousin thing. I think because I am just a little more type A than my husband, while we will say cousin, in my mind, I'm like, well, technically, maybe, like, you know, technically that's, like, second cousin, but, like, we're still going to say cousin. Yeah. Cause I'm like, why's your cousin? Like, sir, you're 29. Why's your cousin 60? You know?
Right.
Like, you're doing the, like, math in my head. But yeah, we I think the part that we think about more and talk about more a little bit are the traits that we have, very cultural traits that come from our parents that we don't necessarily want to take on, but are, like, norms based on culture with our parents. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, this is not, like, I don't want to say this is a generalized Nigerian thing. It's just, I grew up surrounded by a lot of women who did this, where your identity as a wife and as a mother is the value that you bring in when you can cook and you can clean and you might work a job, but you'll do all of those things and you're the primary nurturer and all of that. That I had a full identity crisis when I got married and I realized my husband loved to cook and he loved to clean. I was like, what am I doing here? Literally, you know, like, what value am I adding here? And it was this, like, you know, the shift I had to make in realizing, oh, it was toxic that I was taught that, like, I have to get all the degrees, or I have to do all the work and just be good at all those things, smile a little bit, stay fit while all that is happening. And, like, kind of work through, like, oh, that was a cultural thing that I took from home. I internalized it. The educated person in me is like, take care of your mental health. You know, I'll be the first to tell somebody, like, find a partner. that would like do life with you and walk with you, your partner, all of that. But I came in with this ingrained, like, I guess acculturated mindset that like I'm a wife, so I'm going to do this and do this and do this, and I'm still going to be successful by doing my dissertation and bringing in money. And it was like it's still slowly being unpacked, but like it was a full-on identity crisis when we got married. And again, I'm not complaining at all. This is an absolute blessing the mom has been thrown out. Like there was things that I refused to learn how to cook because I'm like, he does it so well, I'm going to butcher it, and vice versa. Like some things that it's just going to be me that cooks it because I cook it better. So we're not, weaponizing incompetence, but we're like, learning each other and learning what we want our family to look like and what we want our kids to see that would be different from what their grandparents, what was normal for their grandparents, especially on my side.
So do y'all eat African food?
We do. So there are some foods because Nigerian food is so, they're so diverse. Like I'm Hausa, so I grew up in the north. But so like I think we eat, of course we eat things like jollof and stuff like that, but then there are certain very specific soups that I'm like, you know what, we're going to a restaurant to do that one because I don't even know where to
Where to
start
find the
finding the
ingredient?
ingredients in Chicago, but thankfully he's half Jamaican, so we've eaten oxtail and jerk chicken and all that too. Like we enjoy the foods from everywhere.
Oh wait, so being half Jamaican, that makes it even more interesting. Has he ever been
I
to
know, right?
has he even been to Jamaica?
No, that's a hope we have. We'd really like to go soon. But yeah, on his dad's side, so his dad lived in different countries. He lived in, I think he was born in Jamaica. I can't remember geographically what that math is because his dad has siblings that were also born in different places. But at some point lived in the UK and then eventually came to the US. So he's a very cultured man who married like a beautiful, brilliant Black African American woman from the South, and so as they're raising their kids, their kids grew up to be cultured as well, but like still fall into their Ebonics as naturally and as beautifully, but also can be very professional in his way.
I love it.
So yeah, I know, right? They definitely they have a pretty great they have a very well-rounded system in that side of the
I mean,
family.
the richness in culture, and even the transnational ties that are evident or not yet, but that is also something that I'm excited for you all to like unpack and continue to explore, right? Being able to now see how the Jamaican roots also, or the Caribbean part of that family ties into the continental part of your life and all those things and how they impact. But all right, no, I mean, I think we've definitely talked a lot about your family, and I appreciate you sharing. So let's get into your interests though, because for the sake of time, I do want to touch on just you do a lot of really amazing work, and I think your dissertation and everything, and what we've talked about offline, you've shown a strong passion for something that I think a lot of our listeners need to be more aware of, in terms of like just the gender-based, especially growing up in the North. You mentioned being Hausa. That's another thing that I have to say. I think you might be the God, you might be the only Hausa person I've actually interviewed. So this is
I'm not
exclusive.
surprised. A lot of us end up going to the UK for some reason. I don't
Exactly.
know
Nobody comes to
what that
US like
is.
that. So you're like, it's re very rare for me to like see a Hausa person, and because usually like Igbo or Yoruba people, we might sometimes. I've even interviewed an Ibibio person, but never really Hausa person.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So this is an honor, right? And so like for your experience growing up Northwest, predominantly Muslim, and to be a Christian, but in a space that's predominantly Muslim, and then to also experience the things that are happening there. Which has been, the genital mutilation that happens there. I want you to just share with us a little bit more about that part and why, what drew you to that and your interest and what you're doing with that now.
Absolutely. So I grew up in the first 8, 9 years of my life were in Kano State, which is, you're familiar with Nigerian geography. It is north proper. I was born in Borno State, which is even more north of Kano, if that's possible. And my dad is from Plateau State, a little closer to the middle belt. My family now lives in Abuja, but a lot of my like life experience has been in the north. So a lot of my friends growing up were Muslim. We spoke Hausa. So like Muslims honestly have a special place in my heart. I have
Me
like
too.
I just kind of grew a love and respect for the way that they genuinely like let life and like religion really go hand in hand.
Me
There's really
too.
no separating it. Of course, with every organized religious system, you have your radicals. So we did have to run away from a couple of fires here and there, some jihad, activities popping off in different places. But so that was actually a little connected into how I went into got into public health without knowing that. So when I was in Kano, I was about 8 or so, I had a friend who started to talk about this old man that was coming to their house to visit more often. And around that time, she had just started her period. And we're talking about the playground, which is like fourth primary, fourth, like fourth grade. We're in different classes, like classrooms, but during the break, our
You
break
mean like
time, we'd meet
recess?
by the swings, exactly, recess. And so recess for us was really not a time to like take turns on the swing. We were like having very deep philosophical conversations about the fact that she was about to become a bride. Obviously, we're 8 and 9. We're not, the weight of it. As adults, we're like, whoa. But like as a kid, I was like, man, that's messed up. We can't let that happen. So I had this whole plan. I was like, you're going to escape. You're going to come live with my parents. My parents have three daughters. You'll fit right in and stuff. And it's like a whole strategic plan. I'm like, heck yeah, because we can't let you marry that old man. Ew. He's your dad's age. So I remember going home and explaining the whole plan to my mom, and my mom, in her the best way she could, she was like, absolutely not, we're not doing that. I was like, what do you mean? I'm immediately thinking, wow, is my mom a horrible person? And she explained to me, she was like, well, and I'm obviously gonna paraphrase because it's so long ago. What she was essentially trying to communicate was because of the lifestyle that they have, religion, culture, all of it, she belongs to her family, and so they have the right to decide if she's going to marry this man. And eventually, if she does, which inevitably she was going to, he'll pay a bride price or whatever. Like they believe they're setting her up well for success. But it's just that's just unfortunately what's going to happen. Now, your father and I would not do that with the three of you because we don't believe in that. But then I started to ask questions like, okay, are her parents educated? What area do they live in? What religion are they a part of? All of that. Now, I think questions that I now realize in adulthood, those are the social determinants of health. But then I guess from an early age, started to wonder what are the things around us that will determine the health of of a certain people. So starting to kind of dive into what it meant to be a child bride and everything that happened biologically, all the ways that your body is broken, really, because you're not ready to experience the things that your body was made for adulthood. So in kind of staying in keeping with that, I got interested in medicine. But I really thought at the time, like becoming an MD is like the best way to deal with this, or to understand it, or to help people. Because people were doing work in health spaces, but at the time, public health was not a buzzword. It wasn't a part of everyday conversation. And if you were going to make your parents proud, you were going to become an MD
MD,
or
that was
like
always
a
a standard.
lawyer, right? Or an engineer or an
The
architect,
big four.
like
The big
biggest layers.
four. You know the big four.
Exactly. So when it was time to go to universities, the schooling system there is you're done with primary school, secondary school, and then you go to university. And if you're going to go the MD route, you really just go straight from secondary school
To
into
MD.
medical school. Of course, you take your prereqs within that medical school space. So I was going to go to, I wanted to go to really one of the best medical schools there in the north, up north in the state I was born, Borno State. But around that time, Boko Haram really started
Being a
to
thing.
pop off. Let me just put it like that. And my parents were like, absolutely
Absolutely
not.
not.
Like, we're sending you abroad. Go online, find a school. So long story short, it was really a supernatural process between starting to look for schools to eventually finding Loyola in Chicago. But like it literally involved dreams and visions. Like I did not know Loyola was a school in the US. Like it was like a vision that it didn't even, it was like literally a big brown door with the blue tag that does not exist anywhere. It wasn't until years later when I was like in my, I think my freshman or sophomore year at Loyola, sitting at my desk, that picture came back and I called my mom. I was like, what was that? This is honestly just a paraphrase, like a short version of it, because we don't have a lot of time. But my mom was like, that door doesn't exist anywhere. And it turned out it was just a vision that the Lord was giving me of the door that he was going to open for me. I end up at Loyola. I'm in some global health class or something like that. And the assignment was to write on some global health issue that you're interested in. You have to pick a different country. And of course, I'm like, oh, write about something in Nigeria. And I came across this topic that was talking about female genital mutilation in African countries. And I remember feeling so livid because I was like, this is just another Western paper trying to find something wrong with an African country. And I'm just so irritated. And so I'm like going into this rabbit hole to try to disprove it. And then I find scholarly articles written by scholars in the universities in the state I grew up in. One of them specifically was Bayero University. I think one of my uncles went there. And I was like, oh, wait, these people are writing about female genital cutting it like in Nigeria. I was like, but as someone who grew up there and who had dived into women's health and all of that, I was like, how did I miss this? Like, I come from a family of daughters. How did I miss this? And it was like really like a combination of like shock and like I was like, I'm ashamed of myself. I'm not a real Nigerian, blah, 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 what? And just in diving into it more, and this kind of became my next 10 years of like diving into FGM and what it meant, I realized Nigeria actually has a much smaller prevalence than other parts of the world. So like the BBC will report it's about 29% prevalence, but other places report 40%, which is a really wide range. But when you have underreporting and like shame behind a practice, of course,
That's
statistics will
key.
look different.
That's
But
key.
I found that places like Somalia and Djibouti had a 97 and 98% prevalence, which is significantly high. It kind of made me feel better, like, okay, maybe there's a reason I didn't know. As far as Nigeria, it wasn't just happening in the north, it was happening in the west, in the east, among Christians, among Muslims, among traditionalists. It was like it had no, there's no template as to what the typical survivor of genital cutting would
Look
look
like,
like.
Wow.
But so let me just backtrack a little bit on what it actually is. What so I'll just say FGM, because female genital mutilation is kind of a mouthful. It's in many parts of the world a traditional rite of passage. It that basically allows you go from being a child to a woman. There are four types, and different types are practiced in different parts of the world. But type one is called a clitoridectomy. That's where the clitoris is cut off or it's shaved. Type two is called an excision, and that's where you're cutting off the clitoris and the labia minora, so a little bit of the flesh on the inside. Type three is an infibulation. So you're doing all of that, some combination of type one and two, and you're sewing up the vulva completely to completely cover the urethra and leave a straw-size opening for the vaginal canal. So imagine what that means for the field of urology, right? Where urine, it's like basically impossible to keep your genital area clean. Urine sprays instead of flows. It is there are multiple people who, report complications with their bladder and kidney and all of that. Type four is
There's a
essentially
type
everything.
four.
There's a type four.
Oh man. I'm sorry. I mean, I
It's
know
like
you mentioned it earlier. I'm still just I'm processing it and you I
you're
just realized
processing it. I
like
know.
damn, wait, there's more. I'm sorry. But keep
I
going.
know. It is this is the
Wow.
last type, but type four is the least common type, and it ranges from everything from like cauterizing the area to stabbing to piercing. It's really whatever it doesn't really fit in types one, two, three, we just kind of
Put it in
classify
type
under
four.
type four.
Jeez. I mean, I
I know.
can only imagine. And now I want to, and this is a very ignorant question,
Oh, go ahead.
but is this something that some of the women choose to do?
Great question. So,
Participate to be
yes,
part
in
of for the
some
sake of the
cases, some
culture?
people. In some cases, some people choose to. So, when you grow up knowing that something is a cultural rite of passage, it is like your right into womanhood, your mother, your grandmother, your aunties, the people of authority that you respect in your life have experienced this and they've encouraged it. There's a kind of hypnotizing you can carry yourself through. Yeah. So in some traditions, the girl is cut like 8 days after she's born or when she's a little older. Mm. The first couple of survivors I talked to were 7 years old when they were cut. Some people, they kind of wait till your period has started. So it's a whole experience of starting your womanhood. But some people wait till they're about to get married because in some context, in some cultures, the spouses, the men have been kind of trained to prefer that in their wives. And so so to prepare her for marriage, she experiences cutting. So yeah, some people choose it, which is why in some spaces you'll hear advocates or anti-FGM advocates calling it FGC, female genital cutting, because there are people who are dealing with multiple health consequences, but they believe that that rite of passage was appropriate. So it's really insulting, or they
say that as mutilation. Insulting.
Exactly. So you'll hear people say FGC and FGM. What I don't let people say is female circumcision.
Exactly. And that's why I didn't say that.
Thank you. Yeah. I would have caught it right away if you said it.
I hate that terminology.
They're completely different. And not everyone is about male circumcision anyway.
Right.
But male circumcision, you're just cutting off the foreskin. Exactly. And there's actually data in some parts, especially coming from like South Africa, where HIV is highly prevalent. There is like a 60% less a chance of contracting HIV if you're circumcised, like male as opposed to uncircumcised, right? So there's data that shows there are actually health benefits. With FGM, not only is it extremely violent, there is no doctor. Of health benefits.
It might most likely be harmful.
Absolutely.
I mean, we talk about like because we can argue that, I mean, not argue, but we can discuss the idea when it comes to male circumcision that, you know, there are, like you said, positive benefits in terms of just like hygiene and all those other things, right? Mm-hmm. Like you can, like, what it can mm-hmm. do in terms of cleaning that area of your body. But from what you just described about how that process goes with the FGC, it does not sound like there are many things, especially if you're closing it up and you're creating more opportunities you're putting yourself more at risk for infections and different types of things.
Yeah. And you can find multiple peer-reviewed articles that document some of the side effects. So everything from excessive bleeding to sepsis and shock. Some people have died from excessive hemorrhage. There have been reports of PTSD and anxiety and vaginismus. So for anyone listening who hasn't heard that term before, vaginismus is the involuntary contracting of the vaginal canal that can make sex very painful. And a lot of times it's connected to trauma. And so some women who have experienced FGM experience vaginismus as a result, especially when they can remember their experience of FGM.
Yeah. I mean, and so what I'm thinking about now is just the idea of in the Western world here in the U.S., right? And that's something, of course, that is when you think about FGC is not something that's, of course, embraced, right? Most likely frowned upon.
Not anymore. It was at some point. I can tell you about that.
Oh, okay. And so I mean, I don't want to take too much more of your time. I'm sure we could be able to unpack this and do a part two, but I think the idea now I'm thinking about is like, okay, so what about those people who had that experience and then immigrated here to the U.S., the transnationals who are, I'm not going to say victims, but who experienced FGC and what their experiences are like now, because you're in a country here where, I mean, most places, and I think there's some political conversation and divide in terms of sex education, knowing your body, especially when it comes to women. Right. But I think even the idea of proposing sex for pleasure, right, is for women and all those things. And when you experience something like that, what does that do to the mind of those people who really didn't get that experience? Maybe you're looking for it, were taught that sex was just meant to be for babies. But now you understand that there are different ways in which a woman can explore her body, and you might be handcuffed because of that.
So there are, sorry if that, you just heard that. Hopefully you didn't. My email thing.
No, you're good.
So there are kind of two things that you were talking about there that I'll address separately. So There are a lot of people who end up immigrating from parts of the world where it was celebrated, it was legal, all of that, and they come here because it has not it, because it's been illegal in the US since 96, which side note was yesterday. We were alive in 96.
Wow.
It's been illegal in the US since 96. It's not part of discussion in medical spaces, right? So unless you go into the continuing education part, but medical students are not hearing about this. So you have people who start their practice and are meeting these, global travelers who have experienced this and are unprepared. I was listening to a story of a survivor a few months ago who, when she first immigrated to the US, I believe she had just gotten pregnant. It was a prenatal visit or it was a physical, one or the other. She's at the doctor's office anyway. There's about to be an examination, and the doctor, proceeds to look her up and has a very physical,
Reaction.
visceral reaction because they weren't prepared for that. And guess who just was not going to go to a doctor ever again after that? And with communities like that are very tight-knit, you have word of mouth. So as a woman who has experienced something so niche and so specific and so damaging, when you have a great experience with your doctor, you're going to tell the other women in your community. When you have a terrible experience with your doctor,
You're
you will
gonna
tell
tell
the
the
other
women
women
in the
in your
community.
community, right? So where and this is, I'm taking a little break from this because it has been a pretty long time, but where I started to do some work was trying to educate medical professionals on the implications of FGM for their field. So like right now, you'll mostly find like nurses and a few gynecologists here and there that have heard of it, but there are implications for the fields of urology and surgery and pediatrics and emergency medicine and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of work to be done in helping medical professionals get ready for potentially meeting this because we have globalization going on. People are immigrating. There was something else you said I wanted to address. Oh, yeah. So bodily autonomy and exploring one's body and all of that. That is definitely kind of still ongoing. So it's been a while since I've done some work with SAO, but a few months ago, I wrote a paper for them on intersectionality, and they're specifically an anti-FGM group. They're fantastic. They're relatively small, but their impact is huge. It's powerful. They originated from the Bora community, Dawoodi Bora, which is an Indian community, but here in the U.S. And they've been addressing the intersectionality of FGM and other topics, including bodily autonomy. And so, basically, like helping people tell their stories so that it's normalized, so that if you are a survivor who has kind of been living in shame, you can hear that somebody else has been struggling with their sexuality and like what that means in the dating world and all of that when she has no sexual sensation or when she's terrified, even if she does, and what that could mean with her religious, her religious bent, right? Because in a lot of situations where people experienced FGM, it was because it was ordered by a religious leader. So what does that mean for experiencing your bodily autonomy while subscribing to this religion while working through the experience of violation, So it is unfortunately not a one-track conversation. You always meet people who would do it again, who believe that that was a rite of passage, but still want to deal with the fallout that has come out of that. It's a very, you can see it's a very complex
It's very
topic.
complex and even to some degree a convoluted one, right? Because I mean, it shows the impact of culture on one's choices and attitudes regarding a variety of things, including your body, right? And what choices you make for your body, very similar to how that influences abortion, right? And but it's it but what makes it a lot more emphatic in this case is, of course, we're focused on, issues related to women. This is a gender specific matter, right? And it's something that, in addition to all the controversial ones that we hear about in the States here, this isn't something that, like I said, historically, I'm sure you have information on this, but this isn't something that's often talked about. In It's not something that I know, and I'm not necessarily trying to, I guess I could unpack it. Let's just do it, whatever. But like, it's not something that I hear happens to white women, right? Like, it's just not something that it doesn't happen with white women. And not to say that it hasn't before, but it's just not something that, at least in recent times, that I hear about. It usually predominantly happens in black and brown, maybe mostly black spaces.
You will be surprised.
Really?
So I was talking, I know we're running out of time. Just quickly give you this one. So I was talking with a psychiatrist, I think it was sometime early last year. And, you know, she's white and she's been practicing and she really has a heart for FGM survivors. Mm. She's really the only psychiatrist I know specifically that has like walked with multiple women from different parts of the world who have experienced this. She started an organization called Forma specifically for that. So we're talking about it. I'm like, oh, finally, another academic, you know, in this space, because she was in Chicago as well. And she goes, let me tell you something. I'm starting to encounter white women who have experienced FGM, but they survive, they escape from cults. So their experience is different in the sense that they don't have community in a way that a lot of the other transnational survivors in the US now do, where it was your mom's experience, your sister's experience, and your aunt, but you're also tight-knit and you're walking through what this means together.
Yeah.
As a cult survivor, not only have you left everything you know and left your beliefs and all that, you're ostracized.
Yes.
Nobody wants anything to do with you. And you're all like, there's a gag order on you basically where you can barely talk about your experience about them. Exactly. So so there are white women who have experienced this. There are very few.
That's a good one. I don't even, and that's my ignorance in terms of, that's an overlooked part, right? Unless I'm watching a documentary on Hulu or something, I'm really, that's not something that essentially comes to my mind. And that's the, that's just my bias.
And I mean, one of the ways that, I guess an indicator of just how serious this is even though I know of a few of them, I don't know their real names. Because that's intentional. With the ones who have been brave enough to come out, and like we've had to protect their identities. Yeah. But for a lot of the other women who have experienced it, who come from Nigeria or India or some parts of some other parts of Asia, I know their real names.
Yeah.
First name, last name, I know where they were.
Yeah.
You know, all like it's just publicly available information.
Yeah.
They're sharing their stories. It's not to make it any, it's not that it's been any easier for them, but that identity piece looks a little different when you, you know, when you've run away from a cult.
And so just kind of going back to that, my point in terms of how it's intertwined with culture and even the interesting aspect of what you're doing in the, with transnationalism is just that the cultural piece, the retention of culture and what that does for someone. When you travel with your culture, that remains who you are and that influences your choices of whether you're here, you're back there, how you respond to certain things. I find it very fascinating how something, a practice like FGC is, how that would be retained or the, how it'd be perceived with migration patterns, right? And so that's something that I hope, you know, to talk more about you in the future, but because we're pressed for time, I won't get into that. But I do want to just wrap up this by having you answer this one question. With this work, what do you want the overall greatest impact? What do you want your legacy to be? How do you, what do you want it to, what do you want this to do for the community you care for?
It's a good question. So I want it to be said, whether it's by just one random doctor somewhere, that they heard about this because they heard me talking about it or they heard me at some conference or whatever. And so they dove deeper into it. And because of that, several women that have come through their practice have had a healthy experience. They've had risky health behavior go down. They've had a doctor who understood them and walked with them. Because I think at the level that I'm working at, I'm not going to be the face of it. And I'm really not trying to be. I just want to be the person that gets to drop that information and just keep moving, kind of drop as many seeds as possible along the way. So it really, at the end of the day, I want to know that I've done everything I could to inform and inform and inform, and whatever ripple effect that is going to have, hopefully in heaven one day I'll know, like one day it'll be like some lady that's like, you don't even know, girl, but like my daughter escaped FGM because of you, you know, because you randomly told the doctor. So I'm very, very content with being in the back. Well, because they're incredible people, way, way smarter than I am, more influential than I am, that are doing a lot of really great work on the ground. But just getting to be on this end to prepare the doctors for when those influential people have sent the women this way, I enjoy being a part of that.
Yeah. Yeah, I love it. I love it. Oh my God, Dr. Jessica Puri, thank you so much for jumping on the show, sis. I wish we had more time to talk, and maybe another time in the future we can have you jump on and talk more again. This was fun. Definitely want to talk a little bit more about your personal upbringing and your cultural experiences. We didn't get to talk too much about that, and we'll save it for the other one. But how can people reach you? They want to learn more about your work. They can contact you and network.
Yeah, so my email and my LinkedIn are the easiest because I get both on my phone, just like text messages. So jessica.puri@northwestern.edu. It's a pretty good one to get me on. Or on LinkedIn, it's just Jessica Puri, and there's like an MD, PhD MPH after it, because there are a lot of Jessica Puris. I got to stand out somehow.
All right, sis. Well, thank you so much for jumping on the show, and looking forward to having you on again sometime in the future. But as you know, we're here to support whatever we can do to make sure that your work continues to spread and people can feel that impact that you're looking for in the long run. We are here to kind of make sure that that happens. So thank you again for jumping on the show.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure.
So that's going to do it for this episode of My Black is Transnational. If you like what you heard, please be sure to rate, subscribe, and review the podcast. You can learn more about this podcast by visiting our website at blacktransnational.com. You can follow me, the host, at blacktransnational_ on Instagram, or you can follow the podcast at Black Transnational Podcast on Facebook and Instagram. So, until next time, my name is Dr. Kalechi Bay Lambert. My Black is Transnational, and I hope by the end of this, yours will be too. Peace.